This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. We are going to take a brief departure from poetry tonight and turn to the world of fiction. On February 20th of 2015, Joyce Carol Oates, the celebrated and very prolific author, poet, and playwright, gave a reading from her latest novel, The Sacrifice, at Copperfields Books in Santa Rosa. She has so many works out there in the world. Some of her novels include Carthage, The Accursed, Daddy Love, Mud Woman, and The Tattooed Girl. There are many, many other novels. She has a large list of collections of short story collections, novellas, essays, and memoirs as well. And she also has a number of children's books out there that she published. There are three of them. She has won many awards over the years. She has won the Pulitzer Prize more than once. She has won the Penn Faulkner Award, the National Books Critics Award, the National Book Award, the O. Henry Award, and the list goes on and on. These are not the only awards this woman has won. So her latest novel that she read from at Copperfields that night is called The Sacrifice. It is a fictional account of the 1987 Tawana Brawley case, and you might want to look this up. The girl's name, Tawana, is T-A-W-A-N-A. Her last name is B as in boy, R-A-W-L-E-Y. Brawley, 15 at the time, went missing in Wappingers Falls, New York for 4 days. When she was found in a garbage bag covered with racial slurs and feces, she said that she had been gang-raped by men that included police officers and a prosecuting attorney. She later discounted the rape, but said she had been sexually assaulted. But in 1988, a grand jury concluded that she had made it all up. They think maybe she was afraid to face her very violent stepfather after disobeying him. He had beat her mother and her in the past. And because they found her, or they at least said that she had made up the story, she was sued, as well as her three advisors during the case, by the accused prosecutor for defamation. Among those advisors that was sued was the Reverend Al Sharpton. So this tells you at what level this case rose. As of 1997, Brawley insisted that she did not invent the story. In November of 2007, her stepfather and mother in the New York Daily News also insisted the attack happened, saying, quote, "How could we make this up and take down the state of New York? Oh no, we're just regular people," unquote. They asked that the case be reopened, but as of now, it has not been. Brawley works as a nurse using an assumed name. But let me turn back to the novel by Joyce Carol Oates now, The Sacrifice, which is based on this case. It is a fictional account of this case. Here's what it says on the back cover of her book. When a 14-year-old girl is the alleged victim of a terrible act of racial violence, the incident shocks and galvanizes her community, exacerbating the racial tension that has been simmering in this New Jersey town for decades. In this magisterial work of fiction, Joyce Carol Oates explores the uneasy fault lines in a racially troubled society. In such a tense, charged atmosphere, Oates reveals that there must always be a sacrifice of innocence, truth, trust, and ultimately of lives. Unfolding in a succession of multiracial voices, in a community transfixed by this alleged crime and the spectacle unfolding around it, this profound novel exposes what and who the sacrifice actually is, and what consequences these kinds of events hold for us all. Working at the height of her powers, Oates offers a sympathetic portrait of the young girl and her mother, and challenges our expectations and beliefs about our society, our biases, and ourselves. As the chorus of its voices, from the police to the media to the victim and her family, reaches a crescendo, the sacrifice offers a shocking new understanding of power and oppression, innocence and guilt, truth and sensationalism, justice and retribution. A chilling exploration of complex social, political, and moral themes, the enduring trauma of the past, modern racial and class tensions, the power of secrets, and the primal decisions we all make to protect those we love. The Sacrifice is a major work of fiction from one of our most revered literary masters. So let's go now to Joyce Carol Oates reading from The Sacrifice. She is introduced here by Vicki DeArmond at Copperfields Books in Santa Rosa.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Copperfields Books. 3 years ago, Copperfields Books had the honor of hosting Joyce Carol Oates at our Petaluma location for her novel, The Accursed. Luck is surely with us as we get to host her once again. Ms. Oates defines the term writer. Over the course of her career, she has literally written it all. Fiction and nonfiction, poetry and plays, personal memoirs and epic family sagas, children's and young adult fiction, humor and horror. Her latest book, The Sacrifice, is a twisted tale of race, community, and pride. Given the current state of race relations in the United States today, the subject is timely. Given the caliber of this writer, the book is bound to be timeless. Joyce Carol Oates is a recipient of the National Medal of Humanities, the National Book Critics Circle Ivan Sandroff Lifetime Achievement Award, the National Book Award, and the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. She is the Roger S. Berlin Distinguished Professor of Humanities at Princeton University, and she has been a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters since 1978. Ladies and gentlemen, Joyce Carol Oates.
Thank you so much for that gracious introduction. I'm feeling a little posthumous. But it's lovely to be here. And can you all hear me quite well with this?
No.
How did you know what I said? I asked if they could hear me, and they all said no. Maybe you can hear me now.
Yeah.
Now they're very fickle. It's a very fickle audience. I'm just saying they can hear me. Okay, well, I would just say all over again, I'm really happy to be here. And I had been at the Petaluma store a couple of years ago. It was really so impressive. It's such a kind of cozy place. I mean, not that it's small, but it just feels that one could be browse here very happily. So I'm very happy to have a conversation with people after I finish reading just the first chapter of the novel. It's my happiness basically is going out and meeting people, and I love teaching and working with students. Writing is very intense and somewhat like solitary confinement sometimes, so I feel like a bird that's been loosed out of the cage. But I'll read the first chapter, and then if you have any questions or comments, I would be happy to have a conversation. Just to say, as sort of a preliminary to reading the novel, to reading the chapter, I had written a novel in 1969, which is so long ago, it almost doesn't seem real, but I did write the novel called Them in 1969. It was published, and it was basically, and it was suggested to me by having lived through what's called the Detroit Riot, or the 12th Street Riot. So this is really a long time ago. It was 1967 in July. My husband, Raymond Smith, and I lived in Detroit where we were teaching. And the city of Detroit basically erupted on a very hot July night. I think it might have been a Saturday night. And we were about two blocks away from some of the looting and burning, and we heard sirens, and we were basically, I can sort of remember huddling in this house and hoping that our house wouldn't be set on fire. And just thinking my mind rapidly, but not really thinking of anything coherent, just sort of visceral and afraid. But then as time went on, you know, let's say weeks and months and eventually years afterward, I felt that it had been almost presented to me as a kind of riddle to try to understand some of the complex roots, very complex motives for such an eruption that's sometimes called race riots, but there's so much more to it than that. That's a very reductive and diminishing sort of way of speaking of it. Civil unrest is what the report of the National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders in 1968 called it. Civil disorders also seems like a very anemic term. So I wrote a novel called Them, and that was about a white family. And it doesn't exactly culminate with the riot. That's a high point of the novel near the end, and then the novel has some other chapters and before it ends. In this novel, I always wanted to write a companion novel because I felt that I knew more about the situation. We all know so much more now about white racism in police departments and law enforcement generally, just not treating black citizens as if they were equal to white citizens. And overall, there's a kind of population that's always vulnerable to harassment and misunderstanding and sometimes extreme brutality, which white people pass with a kind of obliviousness, not that we're not interested, but this kind of invisible quality to being white. We don't feel that we are, we don't feel that we're vulnerable in quite the same way. By reading literature and by looking at films, I think we can identify with people very different from ourselves and sort of project ourselves into the lives of others. And this is certainly one of the motives for writing the sort of literature that I'm interested in. It's sometimes called bearing witness, or writing about people who could not tell their own story for reasons having to do with not having the education or being just physically unable to tell their own stories. In some cases, we tell the stories of people who are mute because they're not even alive anymore or they're incarcerated. So I wanted to write a novel from the point of view of a black family. And now this particular novel is set in 1988, and its references to not the Detroit riot of 1967, but the Newark riot of 1968. So in the background of this novel, set in 1987, is this other riot, and the neighborhoods are in the inner city are still devastated from that previous riot. There's a depopulation in the city. Many people fled to the white suburbs. And so this story is basically a story of people who are still trapped in that neighborhood, though in some cases they're really yearning to escape. This is the first chapter called The Mother. October 6, 1987, Pasquane, New Jersey. Seed my girl, my baby. She came like a procession of voices, though she was but a singular voice. She came along Camden Avenue in the Red Rock neighborhood of inner city Pasquane, 12 tight compressed blocks between the New Jersey Turnpike and the Passaic River. In the sinister shadow of the high-looming Pitcairn Memorial Bridge, she came. Like an Old Testament mother, she came seeking her lost child. On foot she came, a careening figure, clumsy with urgency, a crimson scarf tied about her head in evident haste, and her clothing loose about her fleshy, waistless body. On Depp, Washburn, Barnegat, and Crater Street, she was variously sighted by people who recognized her face but could not have said her name, as by people who knew her as Edneta Fry, who was one of Anna Schutt's women. But most of them could not have said whether Anna Schutt was living with this middle-aged woman any longer, or if he'd ever been living with her. She was sighted by strangers who knew nothing of Annetta or Annis, but were brought to a dead stop by the yearning in the woman's face, the pleading in her eyes and her low, throaty, quavering voice. "And have you seen my girl, Sibylla?" It was mid-morning of a white, glaring, overcast day smelling of the Passaic River, a sweetly chemical odor with a harsh acidity of rot beneath. It was mid-morning following a night of hammering rain. Everywhere in broken pavement, puddles lay glittering like foil. My girl, Sibylla, anybody seen her? The anxious mother had photographs to show the startled, mostly sympathetic individuals to whom she spoke by what appeared to be purest chance. Pictures of a dark-skinned girl, bright-eyed, a slight cast to her left eye, with a childish gets-to smile. In some of the photos, the girl might have been as young as 11 or 12. In the more recent, she appeared to be about 14. The girl's dark hair was thick and stiff and springy, lifting from her puckered forehead and tied with a bright-colored scarf. Her eyes were shiny, dark, and thick-lashed, almond-shaped like her mother's. Sibylla, young for her age, and trust him, she smiled at just about anybody. In Jubilee Hair Salon, in Ruby's Nails, in Jack's Rib Joint, in the Korean Grocery, in Liberty Bail and Bond, in Scully's Pawn Shop, in Pascane Veterans Thrift Shop, in Passaic County Family Services, and in the crowded cafeteria of the James J. Polk Memorial Medical Clinic, as in windswept Hicks Square and several graffiti-defaced bus stop shelters on Camden Street, there came a Nedna Fry, breathless and eager to ask if anyone had seen her daughter and to show the photograph spread in her shaky fingers like playing cards. You seen a Sibylla? Yes? Maybe? No? She grasped at arms to steady herself. She appeared dazed, disoriented. Her clothes were disheveled. The scarf tying back her stiff oiled hair was askew. On her feet, water-stained sneakers beginning to fray. Since Thursday, she'd been missing. A day and a night, another day and a night, and most of the time I was thinking she'd be with her cousin Martine on 9th Street, coming there after school like she does sometime. And she forgot to call me, so I was just thinking that's where she was. But now they're saying she ain't there, and at her school they're saying she never showed up Thursday, and there'd be other times she cuts in September when the school started that wasn't known to me, and now nobody seemed to know where my baby is. Anybody seen Sibylla? Please call me, Annetta Fry. My telephone is... Her beautiful eyes mute with suffering and vein with broken capillaries. Her skin looked dark, warm, burnished hue of mahogany. There was an oily sheen to her face that glared in the whitely overcast air. From a short distance, Annetta appeared heavyset. Yet she wasn't fat, but rather stout and rubbery solid, strong, resistant, and even defiant. Of an indeterminate age beyond 40, with a girl's plaintive face inside the puffy face of an aggrieved middle-aged woman. Please, you saying you've seen her? Oh, but when? Since Thursday? That's 2 days ago and 2 nights she'd been missing. Along wide, windy Trenton Avenue, there came Annetta Fry, lurching into Diamond Cafe, and into Wigadoo Shop, and into AMC Loans and Bail Bond, and into Storefront Goodwill, where the manager offered to call 911 for her to report her daughter missing. And then Annetta said with a little scream, drawing back with a look of anguish, "No, no, no police. How'd I know the pace came? Police ain't the ones taking my girl." Exiting Goodwill, stumbling in the doorway, murmuring to herself, "Oh God, don't let my baby be hurt. Oh God, have mercy." Sighted then, making her way past shuttered storefront businesses on Trenton Avenue and then to Penobscot, to Freud, which were blocks of brownstone row houses converted into apartments, and so to Port and Sampson were to blocks of small, single-story stucco and wood-frame bungalows. An observer would think that the distraught woman's route was haphazard and whimsical, following incalculable logic. Sometimes she crossed the street several times within a single block. There were far fewer people on these residential streets, so Edna knocked on doors, called into dim-lighted interiors, several times boldly peered into windows and rapped on glass. "Excuse me, hello. Can I ask you one thing? This is my daughter, Sibylla. She's missing since Thursday. You seen anybody looks like her?" Crossing vacant lots heaped with debris and along muddy alleys, whimpering to herself, she began to walk with a limp. She was panting, distracted. She seemed to have taken a wrong turn but did not want to retrace her steps. Somewhere close by, her dog was barking furiously. Overhead, a plane was descending to Newark Airport. another craned her neck to stare into the sky, as at a sign of God, unfathomable and terrible. Here below were abandoned and derelict houses, a decaying sandstone tenement building on Samson, long known as a hangout for drug addicts, homeless and the mentally ill, which had then to fry, approach heedlessly. Hello? Anybody in here? Hello? And daring to step into the street to stop vehicles to announce to the startled occupants, excuse me, I am Annetta Fry. This is my daughter, Sibylla Fry. She's 14 years old. Last I seen of Sibylla, she'd be leaving for school, and now they say she never got there. This was Thursday. She passed the pictures of Sibylla to these strangers, who regarded them somberly, handed them back to Annetta, and assured her no, they had not seen the girl, but yes, they would be on the lookout for her. At Samson and Fifth, there came sharp gusts of wind from the river, fresh wet air and a sickly sweet odor of leaves and strewn garbage. And there stood Annetta Fry on the curb, pausing to rest, like a laborer who is exhausted after an effort that has come to nothing. No one so alone as the bereft mother seeking her lost child in vain. The heel of her hand pressed against her chest as if she was stricken with heart pain, and she was staring into the distance at the Pitcairn Bridge, lifted and spread like a great prehistoric predator bird, and beyond at the slow bleed of the sky, and on her face tears shone and unabashed. So little awareness had Annetta of those tears, she hadn't lifted a hand to wipe them away. That poor woman, she's scared out of her wits like she ain't even aware who she's talking to. Primarily it was women. During Annetta Fry's several hours of search and inquiry in the Camden Avenue, 12th Street neighborhood of inner city Fascagne on the morning of October 6, 1987, some 60 individuals would be caught Annetta afterward. Of these, a number were women who knew Annetta Fry from the neighborhood and who'd seen her frequently with children, presumed to be hers, including the daughter, Sibylla. But they hadn't seen Sibylla within the past 48 hours, they were sure. Of these were women who'd known Annetta Fry for years, as long as 30 years, when they'd been girls together in the old Roosevelt projects, long since condemned and razed and replaced by a never-completed waterfront esplanade that was a quarter-mile sprawl of concrete and mud, rusted chain-link fences, plastic signs, danger, do not enter, construction. They'd gone to East Edson Elementary in the 1950s and on to East Edson Middle School and to the high school. Some of them had known Annetta when she'd been a young mother. She'd had her first baby at 16, forced to quit school and never return. And during those years when she'd worked part-time as a nurse's aide at the Polk Clinic. A husky, straight-backed, good-looking woman, the gats to smile, warm, rippling laughter that made you want to laugh with her. And there were those who'd known Annetta in the past decade or so, since she'd been living with Anna Schultz in one of the row houses on 3rd Street. Some of the women who'd known Annis when he'd been incarcerated at Rahway Maximum Security and before the time of his first wife's death. Manslaughter was the charge Annis had pleaded to. Had maybe wondered that Annetta, who was younger than Annis by at least 10 years, falling in love with such a man, taking such a risk, and her with 3 young children. Annetta had always belonged to the AME Zion Church on 1st Street. She sung in the choir there, rich, deep contralto voice like Marian Anderson, she'd been told. She never missed church. Sunday mornings with her mother and grandmother and her aunts and her girls, Sibylla and Anvena. Annetta's happiest times you could see in her face. Annis never came to the AME Zion Church. No man, leastway resembling him, was likely to come to the AME Zion Church, where the shock, white-haired minister Clarence Dennis frequently preached himself into a frenzy of passion and indignation on the subject of, quote, taking back Red Rock from the thugs and gangsters who'd stolen it from the good black Christian people. A few years ago, there'd been a rumor of Annetta Fry fired from the Polk Clinic for, maybe, stealing drugs. Annetta Fry charged with bad checks when it was claimed by her she'd been the victim. Annetta working at Walmart, one of those big box stores where you were lucky to get minimum wage and next to no health benefits, but you could buy damaged and outdated merchandise cheap. Over the years, there have been rumors of ill health, diabetes, arthritis, taking their children to relatives' homes to hide from Anna Schutt in one of his bad drunk moods, but Edna had not ever called 911 and had not ever fled to St. Teresa's Women's Shelter on 12th Street, as other women had done at one time or another. Nor had she gone to Passaic County Family Court to ask for an injunction to keep Anna Schutt at a distance from her and the children. And Edna Fry, who loved her children, who did most of the work raising her children, Anna Schutt's several children, along with her own, five or six of them in the cramped household. One of his sons at age 19 shot dead on a Newark street in a drive-by, a fusillade of bullets. Another son at 23 incarcerated at Rahway on charges of drug dealing and aggravated assault, 12 to 20 years. They were an endangered species, black boys, ages 12 to 25, who had to fear for their lives in inner city Pasquane, New Jersey. Annetta had a son too, 10 years old, and another younger daughter. Of the women to whom Annetta Fry showed Sibylla's picture this morning, several knew Anna Schutt well, and at least two of them, Lucille Hirsch and Marlena Swan, had had what you'd call relations with the man years before. Lucille's 20-year-old son, Roderick, was Anna's son, no doubt about that. Marlena's 8-year-old daughter, Angelina, was Anna's daughter. He'd never contested it. Exactly how many other children he had fathered wasn't clear. He'd started young, as Anna said, laughing. He hadn't had time for counting. It was painful to Edna, of course, running into these women, seeing these women cut their eyes at her. Worse, seeing these women with children, the rumor was, Anna was the father. That was nasty. You could see that poor woman scared out of her wits like she ain't even aware of who she's talking to. I saw it myself. Annetta came up to me and my friend Jewel in the grocery, like she never knew who we were. Annetta Frivey, Jewel's enemy, on account of Annis, who ain't done shit to help Jewel out all the time he promised he would. And Annetta looks at us with these blind eyes, saying, "Excuse me, hoping you can help me. My daughter Sibylla, you seen her?" That big girl gone only a day or two, and Annetta was acting like the girl be dead. We thought it was kind of exaggerated. But when you're a mother, you do worry. And when a girl is that age, like Sibylla, you can't trust her. You wouldn't ask Annetta if she'd called the police, knowing how Annis feel about police and how police feel about him. So we said to her, "Oh, we will look for Sibylla for sure. We will ask about her, everyone we know. And if we see her or learn of her, we will inform Annetta right away." And she was crying then. She liked to hug us hard, and she'd say, "Thank you, and God bless you. I am praying he will bless me and my baby and spare her from harm." And we stand there watching that poor woman walk away like she'd be drunk or something, like she'd be walking in her sleep. And we're saying to each other, "What you say at such times when nobody else can hear? Poor Edna Fry. Sure I'm happy I ain't her." Thank you. Very much. I'll be happy to take any questions that people have.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. What you're listening to now is a reading that was given by Joyce Carol Oates at Copperfield Books in Santa Rosa in February of 2015. She was reading from the first chapter of her novel called The Sacrifice. We're moving on now to a question and answer session of the evening, and I will play as much as I was able to capture here that works on the radio, and then we're going to move on back to poetry. This is Word Temple after all. Okay, here we are going back to Joyce Carol Oates.
Yes.
Have you ever had writer's block, and if so, what did you do about it?
This is a question about writer's block. Well, I have to quote my own a tweet that I sent out some time ago, that the only writer's block I really know about is in Brooklyn Heights, and it's a writer's block where all, Martin Amis and Paul Auster and some other writers live. Very expensive real estate. That's right. Tweet. Well, writer's block I think is actually quite common, and I do have it in a way, but I think that we just have to sort of make ourselves work. You know, like you have a certain predilection for going away from your work, and particularly when it's so beautiful here. I'm actually so happy to be here, partly because I'm really from New Jersey. It's like minus one, minus 14 with the wind. And it's so beautiful and surreal in California. All the cliches and all the things that people say about California really turn out to be true. All my friends are writing emails and they're so envious. And the pictures of what it looks like through the window at Berkeley looking toward San Francisco Bay and the flowers and Stella's jays. We even have wild turkeys. So I sent them these pictures. So I'm really, you know, very happy about that. But I have a sense that if you have a project that's worthwhile, you have a certain schedule, a certain discipline. There are some writers, sometimes I'm one of these writers, but I know there are writers who do this. They always go to work at a certain time. It could be 7 a.m. or 9 a.m. They always go to work even though they don't feel any inspiration, or they may have a headache, or they may feel depressed. They go to work and they try to do something. And I think if you try to do something, one of the things I do is I rewrite something I wrote the day before. I can always make it better. I always add something, or maybe I subtract something, but then I feel, well, that's a good start, so it might be 9 a.m. by that point. So it's like just a little boost in ways that you have of encouraging yourself. Now, I've been teaching for a long time, and I encourage my students. Right now I'm teaching at Stanford. I have great students. I'm Stein Visiting Writer at Stanford, and I have an undergraduate advanced fiction class of 13 students, really good, really serious young writers. I try to encourage them to write work that's short enough that they can finish and write it well. And when you finish something and revise it and sort of have it as a coherent whole, there is a kind of indescribable satisfaction that you feel. It might even be neurological, it might be hardwired in the brain. You're done with something and you know it's good and you feel it's the best you can do. You get a little boost of adrenaline and energy to go to the next project. What is really not a good idea for young writers or new writers, or anybody really, is to work on a project over a period of time, over months and months and then years, where it becomes like an albatross around your neck, rather than something that you can complete and send out, even if it's rejected, you send it out again and keep sending it out. But then in the meantime, you're working on something else. It's very satisfying to have something that's finished. So it's good for a new writer or a young writer to take a project that's somewhat modest in terms of its length and structure, so that you can finish it and make it perfect. Because then you get, as I said, this strange little boost of adrenaline, almost like a sense of joy, which is the opposite of what you feel if you have a long manuscript. And we all know people like that, and I've been at summer writing conferences and people come with their manuscripts that look as if they've been around since the sort of moldering. They've been like typed on a real typewriter.
Started there.
Yeah, and it's very sad, but I think if you can avoid that, you won't have writer's block. And then one more thing about writer's block, it often means that you're not quite ready to write it. Just as a film is in pre-production sometimes for years, to get ready to make a film, it may be just a few months of actual filming. The people who do movies do a lot of pre-production, lots of research, all sorts of notes, and everything's ready, then they start filming. And the same is true with writing a novel. You have to do pre-writing, taking notes, which I do a lot of. I'm working on a novel now, and I began to take notes on this maybe 5 years ago. I think I actually had been in Berkeley before when I was working on this, just taking notes. But now I'm actually working on it, so I wouldn't have been able to do it without all the notes. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You recently reviewed Richard Price's Whites in kind of a classic police procedural type of book. Do you have anything like that in mind for yourself? Is there something that would just stay in that genre that you would like to pursue?
This is a question about a novel by Richard Price, writing as Harry Brand, writing as a pseudonym, called The Whites, which my review appeared about a week ago in The New Yorker. Well, I probably didn't exactly say this in the review. I like other novels of Richard Price's better that have much more sociological, kind of anthropological background. This novel is more like as you say, it's like a police procedural. So I wouldn't really, for myself, want to write a novel like that. Richard Price has written many crime novels, but they usually have a lot of background, like Clockers and Lush Life and Freedom Land. I think that's probably his most famous novel. But I wouldn't be drawn to the police procedural. It's first of all, I don't know enough, which is always a good reason not to do something. But also, I'm much more interested in the psychology of people than the plot. Yes.
I enjoyed hearing the first chapter, and I'm wondering, when you try to take on the voice or just the family that you're writing about that's from a different class as well as different race, can you tell us a little bit about your internal or maybe even external work that you have to do in order to put yourself in that situation and speak for other people?
This is a question about maybe acquiring a voice. The novel, I should have mentioned this before, the novel is really composed of separate voices in different chapters. Each chapter has a different point of view. I mean, one person is not so well educated. One person is better educated. One person is a light-skinned Hispanic woman detective. Another person is a white woman who's the younger sister of someone on the police force. I mean, and then there are black people and there are black men, and basically it's sort of an attempt to have a central episode with different people commenting on it. So each voice is different. I have the most fun, I think, with adolescent voices. I think that teenagers can be so funny, especially when they're alone together. They can be very witty and irreverent and sassy. And my girl in the novel, Sibylla, the girl who's missing in the first chapter, she really emerges as a complex figure. She's very difficult and very enigmatic. She has a relationship with her mother where the mother doesn't really know exactly what's going on, and Sibylla is sort of playing the mother. Sibylla is testing and taunting the mother, and the whole thing just sort of explodes. And Sibylla makes a mistake. The mother makes a mistake. It's a family secret that erupts into the headlines, or something that should have been kept within the family is kind of erupting out into the society. But I don't think it's that much harder to write maybe any dialogue. I used to be asked if it was hard to imagine what men are like, if you write about men, if you're a woman. But my answer was really, it's just as hard to write about a woman. You know, if you're writing about someone who's not yourself, it hardly matters who that person is. When I was quite a young writer, I read about older people, and I'd also read about children. But I think it's maybe just a case of doing a lot of reading and listening to people and maybe meditating. I should say I do a lot of reading, so it's not as if I'm not totally aware of black fiction. You know, my friend and colleague Toni Morrison, for instance, is a writer whom I've been reading for decades. Now, Toni Morrison is very interesting because I'm sure you've all read her work. She does write with a sort of black vernacular and very poetic, but at the same time, it's quite enhanced and elevated. So it's more like a Faulknerian poetic prose than it is anything like street language. So Toni Morrison is writing in a voice that both is and is not an accurate depiction of the way black people speak today. And I think that's quite proper, and I think that's the way literature usually is, that people who speak in literature, whether it's Shakespeare or Faulkner or Hemingway, the language should seem fluent and plausible and convincing, but if you look at it carefully, it's heavily stylized. Hemingway's language, for instance, is very stylized. Nobody ever talked the way Hemingway's people talk. But when you read it, it seems very realistic. And so, too, with Toni Morrison's work. And John Edgar Wyden is another black writer who's excellent, but he's very Faulknerian, and so he's sort of taking it to another level. So there's no real accuracy of speech unless you had a tape recorder, but that wouldn't really suit the purposes of a work of art. Thank you. Good question.
Could you speak just briefly about the different crafting of poetry and then prose or novel writing?
The different crafting of poetry and prose and novel writing? Well, if you're a poet, you're really interested in language and in a kind of musical way. Some poets hear the rhythm, so they have a sense of rhythm before they have any words. In other words, it's the rhythm comes first. However, a prose writer, I don't think, is like that. I'm not like that. I'm sure when Shakespeare was writing his great sonnets, he had the form of the sonnet, the wonderful form of the sonnet, was sort of imprinted in his brain. And he was going to write a sonnet, and then he filled up the spaces and the rhythmic spaces with the language. But the form, I think, came first. However, most prose writers, I think, start with characters. I start with people talking. I start with people talking like in a monologue, and they just sort of talk. I'm listening to them, and I want to hear what they have to say. And the more they talk, the more complex they get. And then another person comes along, and when the two people come together, then a story evolves out of that. So poetry is quite different. I sometimes have poetry that's people talking, monologues. I've had some poems in the New Yorker that are people talking, but they're not two people talking, just one person talking. But that's a great question, and it's we could talk about it for a long time. What you give up with poetry is a sense of drama, of plot, and having people sort of bouncing off each other. But what you gain in poetry is distillation and compression. Often when people are very, very unhappy or they have a great loss in their lives, they will go to poetry rather than to a novel. They will pull a book off the shelf. I know for me it was Emily Dickinson, the great poet of loss. And Whitman is a great poet of loss too. There's something about the distillation. If you've had a great shock in your life, you almost don't have the strength to concentrate to read prose. You need something very short. That was my experience. Yes, sir.
Could you say a few words about what working with students, the influence that that has on your writing in terms of energizing or inspiring or the level of energy?
Are you a teacher?
Well, I'm an engineer, but I do a lot of teaching.
Well, I always wanted to be a teacher. And when I was a really, really little girl, I mean, really little, I wanted to be just like my teacher. I was in a one-room schoolhouse, and that sounds extremely archaic. A one-room schoolhouse in the snow belt of upstate New York. And there was a lot of snow. I mean, just like Boston right now is getting all the snow. We got that every year. That was basically it. We were sort of tunneling through shoveling tunnels to get to the garage and so forth. And so I was in this one-room schoolhouse, and I just revered my teacher so much. When I was quite little, I wanted to be a teacher. And I associated the schoolroom and books with a very happy kind of a sanctuary, almost like an oasis of calm and special words and special thoughts. Because outside that, there was a sort of more chaos, and we did not really have a lot of money, and I remember my father being worried about money and there being sort of a strain among the adults. And so when I went to school and had my books, it was really like a repository of peace and calm and something beautiful. So I always wanted to be a teacher. And then however old I was, I wanted to be a teacher of that grade. Like when I was in fifth grade, I wanted to teach fifth grade. I was in high school, I wanted to teach high school. For a while, I was so excited about maybe being a gym teacher. I had this fantasy that I would close the doors and lock everything so that I could play on the trampoline and the rings and ropes, and I could do all this. But then when I got to be a little older and went to college, I wanted to be a college professor. And so on. And it seems like a bizarre fantasy that I would finally become a college professor at Princeton University or Stanford. I mean, it shows that the wildest fantasies can actually come true. So the teaching was my deepest and first love, and the writing was something that I always did, but I didn't think of myself as a writer. And I always work very closely with my students. I have some students who do theses with me, so they come in once a week in a tutorial. And then I have students in workshop, and we critique the work. Basically, we have, I think, a lot of fun. And writers learn that something that they thought was quite clear and coherent when they wrote it is just baffling to other people. Oh, who's this? Who do you mean by he? Like, the other day at Stanford, the pronoun he was sort of mysteriously in this, and most of us didn't even know who the he was. The writer thought it was evident. So he was learning about communication through the workshop situation. I don't know that I'm influenced by my students, but I find that a great contrast with being so intense and locked into the writing. So it's very healthy instead of social. Maybe just a couple more questions? Yes.
This is Catherine Hastings. I'm going to paraphrase the next question that was asked of Joyce Carol Oates because it was just too hard to hear on the recording. The woman said that she really enjoyed hearing the first chapter of The Sacrifice and asked Oates if she used her imagination to envision the setting of this chapter or if she actually travels to the places she writes about. Here's Oates's answer.
Yeah, so this is a question of, like, the first chapter of the novel. I want my writing to have a very visceral and sensuous immediacy. Yes, it's sort of based on Trenton, New Jersey. It's a fictitious city. It's a small city in New Jersey. It's a little bit based on Trenton, New Jersey, which I know a bit, and a little bit based on Detroit in my memory. Just sort of walking along and identifying with people who may have lost something and trying to find it, and how heartrending that would be. One more question? Yes.
This is Catherine Hastings again. The next and final question asked of Joyce Carol Oates was posed by a woman who said that it's obvious that Oates doesn't always write from memory. For instance, how could this college professor, this woman who is currently teaching at Stanford University, write such a chapter, or perhaps write anything that she hasn't experienced directly herself? Here is how Joyce Carol Oates answered the question.
I don't know how to answer that, really. I think we have deep within us identification with all kinds of people, very different from ourselves, and just sort of meditating and thinking about other people. Sometimes there's research involved. I certainly did a lot of research for my novel, The Accursed. It was pleasurable, but it was real research, you know, actually going to a library at Princeton University, where the letters of Woodrow Wilson were kept and other special things in a special collection. But the novel that I had the most challenge with and anxiety that was researched was my novel Blonde, which is about Norma Jean Baker, who became Marilyn Monroe. So that I did some very various kind of research into the politics of the time, sort of Cold War America, and the Red Scare, Joseph McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, and then the pop culture, the movies people were seeing, and the kind of wonderful actors, era of great movie stars and some old-fashioned movies. And then Norma Jean Baker herself, who was an orphan. She was almost like an Okie. She was a dispossessed child in Los Angeles, and she lived for some time. She stayed in orphanages, even though she had a living mother, but her mother couldn't take care of her. But the most pleasurable research for that novel was seeing all of Marilyn Monroe's movies that I could see in chronological order. So that I was taking notes and just sort of seeing the evolution of a very gifted young actress from being a starlet and sort of just beginning almost like an amateur actress in her early movies, and then developing amazingly. And by the time she is quite mature, a remarkable actress and an extraordinary comedian. Some like it hot. She's really, really funny. It's not easy to be funny, And then she plays tragic figures in The Misfits, and she played a sort of a seductress in Niagara. And each one of these performances, I think the average moviegoer kind of took for granted. And she was never really admired or appreciated in Hollywood at the time she was working. So I learned a lot from the research for that, and I really wish that I could find another subject like that. I thought of Marilyn Monroe as my Moby Dick. Because she became emblematic of not just women, but even men who have to sort of sell themselves, who are trying so hard to make it in America. Maybe one more question?
Okay, there's actually one more question that was asked of her, and this had to do with the extensive research that Joyce Carol Oates sometimes does in preparation for writing a novel, and how she then accesses all of her notes that she has taken, and how she works with that. Here's Joyce Carol Oates.
Well, I should restate that. I didn't do 5 years of research. I probably had 5 years while I was working on other things. But, you know, you come across something and you write it down, then you may be working on something else, but you sort of keep your eye open for something that's relevant. So it was more like that. I can't imagine working steadily for 5 years just doing research. I mean, personally, I don't have that kind of stamina. I couldn't do that. The best way to write a historical novel, I think, is to just start with your characters and then do your research as you go along. And write about human beings and sort of human relationships, and then you can always set them in place and have them intersect with historical events. But I feel that we really care intensely about people, and we're sort of, I think, less interested in some of the historical events that they find themselves in. And this novel was suggested. It's not about, actually not about the Tawana Brawley case. It was suggested by that phenomenon, which became a media scandal. And at the time, it was a little like the Chappaquiddick incident. I wrote a novel called Blackwater. These things get into the public consciousness, and they become emblematic. Like, Tawana Brawley was a young black girl who accused white policemen of having raped and beaten her and imprisoning her. It turned out not to be true, and when you read about it, I read the grand jury, the findings of the grand jury is in my bibliography here. When you read about it, you see that it was never really very plausible at all, but there was something about the story that made it, today we would say it went viral, because it had all these symbolic qualities to it. And what started off as a young girl sort of making something up just caught into like wildfire and just went out into the collective consciousness. But I wanted to write a novel about that phenomenon, how the media takes it, the media took it and just exaggerated and sort of ran with it to sell newspapers or just for various reasons. People who probably knew, I'm sure, that it wasn't legitimate, nonetheless, they amplified it. And in so doing, they really destroyed the lives of many people who are quite innocent. So one of my chapters is called The Good Son, and that's about one of the very innocent victims of this scandal. But in my novel, the girl is actually beaten. She is actually raped. It is not a hoax, because I think it's much more true that young girls, whether black or white, and whether women or girls. I think there's so much sexual molestation and rape that's not reported, and many people just don't want to talk about it, and they suffer in silence. That, to me, is much, much more real and relevant and representative than a hoax. A hoax is actually very rare. I mean, the Twyla Bradley hoax is maybe one in, 5 million, but there are all these other girls and women, and there may be boys as well, and others who are molested and badly treated and don't really don't get justice and don't get treated, don't be taken seriously. But the novel finally moves toward a resolution, and one does find out who did this to her and maybe why, and it moves on in a way that the historical event didn't. Historical event was never really properly resolved. Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Joyce Carol Oates reading from her novel, The Sacrifice, recorded at Copperfields Books in Santa Rosa in February of 2015. This has put me in the mood for Billie Holiday, so let's go out on God Bless the Child. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM.
Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Money, you've got lots of friends, they're crowding round your door, but when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come no more. Rich relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Lots of friends, they're crowding round your door, but when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come no more. Rich relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much.